from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Hong Kong was returned to China in 1997 after more than 150 years as a British colony, the deal with Beijing was famously this: one country, two systems. Hong Kong would have its own freedoms under Chinese sovereignty. Right now in the streets of Hong Kong, exactly what that means is being tested. This hour on Point, China, Hong Kong, democracy, and the umbrella revolution. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see happening right now in Hong Kong? Can these students and protesters stand up to China and win democracy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will take a good hard look at recent Secret Service failures and the safety of the President of the United States. Very hot grilling and testimony in Washington on that front yesterday. But first to Hong Kong and days of huge protest there. Tens of thousands more in the streets as they blocked a road leading to Hong Kong's financial district here. And over the weekend, police using tear gas, pepper spray to clear a crowd of pro-democracy protesters gathered outside government headquarters in Hong Kong. And still they come. Beijing is not happy. Where this goes, nobody knows. In a CNN interview on Tuesday, here's Hong Kong protester Edward Tsui talking about the protests.
We are Hong Kong people. We just normally sit in our office. We don't do that often. Right now, we have tens of thousands of people sitting in the street, demonstrating, be prepared for the next round of tear gas or even rubber bullet. So we are terrifying, but we still need to do this because it's for our future. We want real democracy.
Real democracy, but also terrifying. BBC talked with this student protester Sunday night about why the protests so important to him.
If we miss this chance to fight for ourselves, I think Hong Kong will have no future. That's why we are here.
And it's not just the young. Here's an elderly protester talking with the BBC.
My name is Lung Ying Lan. I'm 76 years old, just a housewife. Hong Kong is such a mess merely because it's asking for a universal suffrage. We must do our best to support the youth.
Just because it's asking for universal suffrage, they want the vote there. Joining me now from Hong Kong is Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times. Keith, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show again.
And with us today from New York is Barbara Demick, Beijing bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Happens to be in New York right now. Barbara Demick, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
I have to say right off the bat, I lived in Hong Kong for some years, was there in the 1980s in the room when the deal was rolled out. We were kept sealed from the public for several hours while we read it, then reported it. Here we are all these years later, and we have these big crowds in the streets. Keith, what's the status today? Are the crowds keeping up? Are the protests keeping up? Do they show any signs of diminishing?
The crowds show no sign of diminishing whatsoever. I'm here down at the edge of the crowd right now. I've stepped out of the crowd in order to speak with you. There are still very large numbers of youths pouring out of the subway, almost as many as who are going down the subway. Now, people definitely, some are going home because they're tired from having spent a whole day in sweltering heat here, but you have a constant flow of new arrivals that is replenishing a crowd which is easily in the many tens of thousands. Some organizers say it might be in the hundreds of thousands. They say they don't have the time or the expertise to do a true crowd count. But when you see the just block after block of people crowding in, many of them, probably most of them, wearing yellow crossed ribbons that for Americans might be a symbol of bringing hostages home, for example, during the Iranian crisis in 1980, but which here are being used as a symbol of what some are calling the umbrella revolution, that in honor of those who were holding up umbrellas to try to block police pepper spray on Sunday night.
And for those who know Hong Kong, Keith, this is not just there at the Admiralty District in the center of Hong Kong. This is also on Hong Kong Island in Causeway Bay, big crowds. Also in Kowloon, in Mong Kok, big crowds there as well.
That's correct. They've been able to really block some of the biggest shopping districts in Hong Kong, including areas that are very popular with mainland Chinese tourists. And this is one of the biggest, usually one of the biggest weeks of the year for mainland Chinese tourists to come here. This is a so-called Golden Week starting today, a seven-day national holiday in honor of China's National Day. It's only a one-day holiday in Hong Kong, but a week-long one in the mainland. Now, the mainland government has abruptly halted permission for further tours to come here, but there are already quite a few mainland tourists here, and they're certainly getting an eyeful.
Barbara Dimmock, can you imagine, what do you know about how Beijing is looking at this? Why they would be concerned about tourists seeing this? Why they are shutting down all kinds of social media across China when it comes to reports of this, Barbara?
Well, they just don't want anybody in mainland China getting ideas, any kind of protests in China that have called for, more than, minor points on environmental issues will be very harshly dealt with. There's really a zero tolerance policy for protests. So for mainland Chinese seeing fellow Chinese, well, their ethnic nationals protesting on the streets like this, it could be very destabilizing.
And especially when they're calling for democracy, that's a hot button. Keith Bratcher in Hong Kong, exactly what are these crowds, the protesters, asking for in terms of democracy? Hello, Keith, are you there? Barbara, maybe you can lay that out for us.
Democracy is what they're calling it. But what they really want is the right to determine their own government. They're not, calling for the downfall of the Chinese Communist Party in the mainland. They want China to keep its promises to allow them to elect their own chief executive in 2017. Hong Kong is really a very different country. It's not like they're Tibetans or Uyghurs. They're ethnic Chinese, but they speak their own language, Cantonese, not Mandarin Chinese, like in the mainland. They have this British-infused culture where they don't tolerate spitting or eating in the subways, and they want, some say in their own governance.
In particular, they don't want the candidates to succeed the current head of Hong Kong, the CEO there, as they call it, CY Leung. They want those not to be nominated just by this insider committee of those close to Beijing. Denise Ho joins us right now from Hong Kong, assistant professor in the Center for China Studies at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. She wrote recently an open letter to her students who are protesting. Denise Ho, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What are the hopes at this point? Are the protesters in the streets still feeling hopeful that they will somehow get what they're asking for?
I think if we were to think about how people are hoping the outcome will be, it's really changed since before the weekend and after the weekend. I think that before the weekend, even the most optimistic students thought that there would be the class boycott. They weren't sure what was going to happen next. They thought there might be a much longer term struggle to reach dialogue or democracy with the government. But now I think that the hope is to take a stand, to demonstrate that Hong Kong people are politically aware, that they care about their futures, that this is a multi-generational movement. I don't think I would venture to say how I think it will turn out, but I think people are much more hopeful on the streets after the turning point of the weekend.
And Keith, what about the government in Hong Kong and with its direct line, no doubt, burning up to Beijing? What do they appear to be heading for here? There was heavy police action over the weekend. What about now? Wait them out? Make a deal with the protesters? Crush them?
For now, the government's inclination is very much to wait them out. They feel like time is on their side for several reasons. One, this is a holiday week. It's disruptive, of course, for the stores that appeal to mainland shoppers. But the fact is that both Wednesday and Thursday are public holidays in Hong Kong. It's a fluke of the calendar that Wednesday is the National Day of China, and then there's a lunar holiday that just happens to be in the lunar cycle falling on Thursday. So then there's just Friday's one workday that'll be lost, and it's a weekend as well. It may be tough for the students to sustain the energy of being out for a third week. This began with a week-long student boycott last week. So the government's hope for now is to wait them out. Now, that said, there's some reasons why that might not work. If this starts producing sympathetic, similar demonstrations on the mainland, that could alarm Beijing in a hurry. At the same time, having this kind of confusion for so long, even if 2 days of it are when the stock market is normally closed anyway, may not be good for Hong Kong's image as an international financial center. Both sides are really trying to woo public opinion. The government is hoping that people will not see the demonstrators as really representing them and are creating inconvenience. The demonstrators, however, are trying to show that they're socially responsible. I happened to be walking along this morning and saw a group of half dozen young men who were helping to sling bags of trash onto the back of a truck that was going to carry them to a landfill. I snapped a quick picture on my smartphone and put it on my Twitter account, at Keith Bradshaw. And it was just sort of a scene that showed how responsible many of these demonstrators are trying to be as they want to retain public opinion. Because the fact remains, this is mostly a student demonstration. You haven't seen large numbers of middle-aged and older protesters, or for that matter, families bringing their children.
Keith Bradshaw, Keith, stand by there in Hong Kong. We've got more to learn here. We're looking at China, democracy, and Hong Kong right now. We'll look later in this hour at the Secret Service and the president. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The sound there in Beijing, in China today, of ceremonial celebration of the founding, 65th anniversary today, of the anniversary of the People's Republic of China. But the sound in Hong Kong in recent days, very different. Here in Causeway Bay on Monday, the soundtrack of what's being called the Umbrella Revolution. Do you hear the people sing from the Broadway musical Les Miserables? Very different tune in Hong Kong right now. We're talking this hour about China, democracy, and Hong Kong. And later this hour, the Secret Service and President Obama. You can join us. Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong Bureau Chief of the New York Times with us from Hong Kong. Barbara Demick, Beijing Bureau Chief for the LA Times with us from New York. Denise Ho at the Chinese University of Hong Kong with us from Hong Kong today as well. Here's protesters Monday night chanting for the current governing head of Hong Kong, CY Leung, Leung Cheung Ying, to step down. He has not. We have lots of response from our listeners here. Here's one who says, they are amazing, fully support their peaceful protest, hoping it doesn't turn violent. S.J. Mills says, such bravery humbles me. May God protect them. But here's one from Candace Dung. She says, I am a Hong Kong citizen. What you see and hear from the media only represents certain Hong Kong people's appeal. What you haven't seen or heard, there are more people here who disagree. Keith, what do we know about where Hong Kongers stand on this overall?
There is a big demographic split. As I was mentioning earlier, the crowd here is overwhelmingly young. You're not seeing the middle-aged and older citizens. And it's long been the case that older Hong Kongers tend to be more sympathetic to Beijing. So there is absolutely a sizable chunk of the population, whether it's a majority or not is unclear, that is uncomfortable with this large protest that is blocking downtown streets. On the other hand, the protesters who started off with lukewarm support in some sectors of society seem to have benefited from the scenes of tear gas and confusion on Sunday night. That was viewed by some as an overreaction by the government, and so that seemed to benefit them. But whether or not the protesters can sustain support for a longer confrontation is entirely unclear, particularly now, as I reported this afternoon here, particularly now that the government seems to be taking a wait-and-see strategy, which is on our website, nytimes.com.
One more voice from Hong Kong. Joseph Cheng joins us now, political science professor at City of Hong Kong University and Occupy Central supporter. He was arrested at Sunday's protest, held for 12 hours. Joseph Cheng, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
First of all, Mr. Cheng, I have to thank you. I'm looking here at a story I wrote out of Hong Kong back in the 1980s. You were the first person I quoted in it. Here we are all these years later, following up on the one country, two systems agreement that was made then. Why do the students, why do you in the streets see the stakes as so high right now, Professor Cheng?
We are very concerned that Beijing has cheated us. Beijing promised us democracy, and yet now what has come out is that, yes, Hong Kong people may have universal suffrage, but then the entire list of candidates will be controlled by the pro-Beijing elite. This is not election. This is political mobilization. And people are worried that we have to fight not only for a democratic political system, we are concerned that we may not be able to maintain our core values, our lifestyles, and our individual dignity. We are very worried that Hong Kong may be just reduced into another big city in China. And people have come out because they feel that if they don't speak out today, they may not even have a chance to do so a few years later. Public opinion surveys have consistently demonstrated that Hong Kong people supported the political reform proposal offered by the pro-democracy movement by a ratio of at least more than 2-1, sometimes by a ratio of more than 3-1. I belong to the Alliance for True Democracy, and we have been conducting these surveys through an independent academic organization, the University of Hong Kong. And in the recent days, the public opinion surveys revealed that slightly more than 60% of the people reject the decision of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress. So public opinion is very clear-cut, although we have to admit that some people are afraid to confront Beijing.
Professor Cheng, let me ask you if I may. Beijing has proven itself very allergic to democracy. Xi Jinping, the current leader in China, is particularly strong on being tough on this. He's looked back at the Soviet Union and said it fell apart, quoting him here, the leader of China. He said, in the end, nobody was a real man. Nobody came out to resist. Do you fear, Professor Cheng, that Beijing may come with a crushing blow on these protests if they don't disband soon? We know they did it in 1989, and Hong Kong people know that, even if mainland people are not allowed to talk about, read about Tiananmen.
We have to be very honest. Most people who are now protesting do not believe that the Chinese authorities will make serious concessions at all. But we also understand that if we don't speak out, we may not even have a chance to do so. However, with regard to the Tiananmen Square incident scenario, we don't want to have that kind of thing. And as you have just said, on Sunday, when the police used tear gas, all the organizers asked the protesters to go home. We are prepared to engage in wave after wave of peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience campaigns. We may not be able to achieve everything by one Occupy Central campaign, but we are not going to give up. We are going to initiate wave and wave such campaigns. It is going to be a long-term struggle.
We have callers for our guests in Hong Kong and beyond. Nancy in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I have a comment and a question. I spent about the same time as you in Hong Kong, 12 years working and living. My kids were born there, and I'm just inspired by the bravery of the Hong Kong people, and I just wish them all the best. And I hope they're successful against what seems to be pretty significant odds. But where are the British and the Americans, I want to know? At least the British were signatories, and their names on the papers that promised one country, two systems. Where do we see them jumping in and helping out here?
Nancy, we've got it. I mean, as you well know, they're pretty well off the stage. But let me hold that question and get one more comment, if I may. Tom in Omaha, Nebraska. Tom, you're on.
last week. I think it just goes to show, you know, how far the Chinese, you know, government has come since Tiananmen Square, that they're not rolling down these people with tanks or, you know, actually physically hurting them beyond tear gas.
So a sign of how far Beijing has come. Well, I mean, so far, you're right. We shall see. Tom in Omaha, I appreciate your call. Keith, I know I just have you for another minute. What about Nancy's question, where are the British? Do they have any sway here or voice here at this point? And what about what you see being anticipated in Hong Kong from Beijing, if this goes on, as Joseph Cheng says, for a long time, Keith?
Answers to your questions. First, Prime Minister David Cameron did express concern yesterday about the Chinese government's handling of the demonstrations here and the Hong Kong government's handling of the demonstrations here. He took exception to the tear gas, and he said that he had expected Hong Kong would show more progress towards true and open elections than has actually taken place since the handover to Chinese sovereignty in 1997. So the British are beginning to speak out. The American government, the State Department, has said, has reminded everybody that it favors democracy as a general principle. One difficult balancing act for the British and the Americans is that, to the extent they're more vocal, they play into the hands of Beijing, which portray democracy activists as tools of foreign powers. So the United States and Britain have to very carefully calibrate their remarks to show that they stand on the side of democracy, free speech, and other values like that, without making it look like they're the ones who are organizing or fomenting in any way these protests, which they're not. These really do seem to be protests from the Chinese people themselves. Actually, as for Beijing's evolution and for China's evolution, clearly there has been a lot of evolution. China's, since 1989, become the world's second largest economy, invested very heavily in the latest transcendent tools.
Keith Bradshaw, I'm afraid you're breaking up on us there. I think we got the gist of that. A lot of economic evolution, maybe less political. I'm sorry you're breaking up, but I know we've got to let you go anyway. Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times in Hong Kong. Thank you very much for that. Denise Ho, what do you expect from Beijing if this goes on, as Joseph Cheng says, for a long time?
I think it's in Beijing's interest to wait it out. The latest news, the Wall Street Journal just posted that the Hong Kong government has been ordered not to fire to make sure that this is peaceful. I think that from their point of view, it's better to let the movement. Next week people will be going back to work. Students may not all feel like going on boycott indefinitely. The university is already trying to encourage them to be safe, but to think about returning to classes, that kind of thing. So I think that from their point of view, it's going to be to wait it out. I think that's what they're interested in seeing happen.
Barbara Demick, you cover Beijing for the Los Angeles Times. How long can the Chinese government, Xi Jinping, a tough guy leader, have this go on in the streets of Hong Kong and not begin to be a problem for him on the mainland, at home?
I think the Chinese actually have a lot of cards to play here that people are not looking at. And I don't agree that they've moderated since 1989. I mean, if you go back to the Tiananmen Square protests, some of the stories from early May were very similar about these peaceful students, how orderly it was.
Yes, I remember.
Et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, things spiraled out of control until the June 4th crackdown. But I think the Chinese certainly they've not gotten more tolerant, but they've gotten, maybe more strategic. And as my successor, I'm actually no longer Beijing bureau chief, Julie Mackinnon, pointed out in today's paper, they could cut off the water. They could tighten the borders. They could close the borders. There's a lot of ways they have of punishing Hong Kong in the long term. And I think their strategy is quite clever. They want to wait it out, wait till the older generation is annoyed, and hope that the public mood turns against the students. And, I wouldn't rule them out. I think they still have a lot of cards.
Joseph Ching in Hong Kong. So how are you thinking about this? Is this, are you, you know, is this quixotic? Is it a suicide mission? How do you think this will play out?
Well, I'm very much encouraged by the participation in the protest. Once people feel the power of the people, they are not going to forget, they are not going to give up. But I do agree with our discussion that the short-term prospects are grim. It is not likely that Xi Jinping will make the concessions necessary. He is not interested in serious political reform. China, as we all know, there has been serious crackdowns on the dissidents, on the internet, on the human rights lawyers in China, and so on. Xi Jinping is interested at this stage to consolidate power, to concentrate on economic reforms, and therefore he is quite reluctant to make concessions during his process of power consolidation. Increasingly, Chinese leaders feel that Hong Kong may well be dispensable, and that is exactly why they are no longer interested in ensuring the one country, two systems model. There is a perception that Hong Kong depends on China economically rather than the other way around. And there is a certain perception in China among leaders, among officials concerned, and among ordinary people that Hong Kong people are not grateful for what China has done for Hong Kong. But what we are trying to tell China is that we respect Chinese sovereignty for Hong Kong. We do not want to confront the Chinese authorities. We just want Chinese leaders to carry out what they have promised, a one country, two systems model with a high degree of autonomy, allowing Hong Kong people to elect their own chief executive, and so on. You see, if you turn China, if you turn Hong Kong into another Shanghai, it will be very bad for Hong Kong, and it will not do China any good. Hong Kong people feel that they are very free, and Hong Kong's prosperity, Hong Kong's innovation are very much based on this freedom. If you kill this freedom, if you make people shut up, then Hong Kong cannot survive.
Denise Ho, will these students in the streets be made to pay for this? I mean, China keeps track in China. I don't know about Hong Kong. Will this come back to haunt them? I mean, I see all the support for them and all from our listeners, and I well understand it. What about, we just got a minute here, Denise. What does this mean down the road for those protesters?
I think that the group that I'm most concerned about are the student leaders, and I know that they are also very concerned. The universities have offered them legal help. They're worried that perhaps they might be arrested or their rooms would be searched. And the mood on campus is, what do we do if the police show up? I think that is a serious concern, what will happen to the student leaders. I think in the long term, and what I tried to write about in my piece, is that the thing that I'm worried about is sort of that their spirits will be defeated, that this is something that they, if things do not go as they wish, that they will have stood up for something and confronted power and learned a hard lesson about life. And so that's what I fear most for them.
Hard lessons on life.
That this will not turn out as they wish.
Yeah, big convergence here of aspiration, promises, and power realities. Denise Ho at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Thank you very much for being with us today, Denise.
Thank you, Tom.
Joseph Ching at the City of Hong Kong University. Thanks for talking with me all those years ago and again today, Joseph Ching. Be safe and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. Thank you.
And Barbara Demick with the Los Angeles Times in New York. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
In a moment, serious security lapses around the President of the United States. What's going on? This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Yesterday on Capitol Hill, Secret Service Director Julia Pearson faced outraged questions on how an armed intruder scaled the White House fence, sprinted across the lawn, and made it deep into the White House before being caught. And then news broke of yet another security lapse, a man with a gun and a record of assault and battery on an elevator with President Obama earlier this month. Joining me now from Washington is Del Quentin Wilbur. He covers the Justice Department, Department of Homeland Security for Bloomberg News, author of the book Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. Del Quentin Wilbur, welcome to On Point.
Hey, how are you?
Very well. Listen with us for just a moment, if you'd be good enough, to some of the back and forth on Capitol Hill yesterday. Here was Democratic Representative Stephen Lynch saying he wished to God that Secret Service Director Julia Pearson had protected the White House as much as she was, he said, trying to protect her reputation, and that Omar Gonzalez should not have gotten so far into the White House.
To talk about somebody traversing the White House foyer, the full length of the East Room, down to the Green Room, to the American public, that would be half of a White House tour.
Half a tour, and here's Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz saying deadly force should have been used.
I want it to be crystal clear. You make a run and a dash to the White House, we're going to take you down. I want overwhelming force. Would you disagree with me?
I do want our officers and agents to execute appropriate force for anyone attempting to challenge or breach the White House.
And the hot seat just kept grilling.
Let me be clear. The United States Secret Service does not take any of these incidents lightly. They are all of extreme...
With all due respect, that's my point. If, as a casual observer to what has happened here, I don't think the Secret Service is taking it their duty to protect the American president and his family at the White House. I don't think you're taking it seriously. That's exactly my point.
Del Quentin Wilbur, did you hear anything in the testimony yesterday that would explain the apparent depth of these security lapses?
You know, she basically confirmed the reports the day before. That, remember when the guy broke into the White House, he scaled the fence, ran in the door. And the Secret Service kind of led everyone to believe, and actually said so, that he was arrested just inside the front door.
Yeah, that was the first news report.
He wasn't locked and got in, right?
Yeah.
It's crazy. Well, turns out, no. He went on like a mini tour. He ran around the whole place. He ran like 80 feet into the White House, deep into the building, you know.
He was close to the Oval Office, was he not, in the East Room?
Yeah. Well, everything over there is close to everything else.
Yeah.
You know, like he could have gone up the stairs to the residence, and they finally tackled him. And they didn't disclose that. And that really hurt their credibility at the hearing. I think also, you know, she kind of, they wanted to see more passion from her. Like, I'm really trying to figure out I'm doing this, but that's not who she is. She's more of a, you know, a law enforcement type. She doesn't get fired up like that. And it was just a pounding. It was like watching someone get clubbed with baseball bats. And it's, you know, it's interesting because it was bipartisan. And I find that fascinating. Like, when you look at the fact that like, it was Republicans and Democrats both pounding her because the Republicans want to be tough on security. They want to, you know, look, we're looking out for Obama here. And the Democrats, like, really want to look out for Obama. Like, you're not protecting him. This is crazy. Like, you can't keep having these disclosures after disclosures after disclosures. Now, in her defense, she's only been on the job 9 months. And a lot of this stuff is long simmering in the Secret Service. Another part is, are these just, like, scattered, weird incidents that happened all the time throughout their history? You know, like in 1981, the book I wrote about, you know, Reagan, you know, was shot. That was horrible. But they reacted and saved his life in a heroic way, and that was the narrative, right?
Yes.
My narrative, that's the, you know, but they
nevertheless, he was shot on the streets of Washington. Yeah.
Yeah, from 15 feet away. And so, like, what else was happening back then? You know, like, they finally put magnetometers up at the White House in 1981 after this incident, and they started finding all these old ladies with handguns in their backs. And, like, how many people were walking through the White House with guns, you know, before that? So it's like... You know, I think protection is a really, really, really tough business.
I want to go back first to Omar Gonzalez, and you're right. The head of the Secret Service, Julia Pearson, really pounded on yesterday on that front. Here was Republican Congressman Daryl Issey just kind of slapping his forehead again and again. How could this happen?
He was placed on the ground, on the carpet, and handcuffed on the crosswall hall just outside of the green room. There is
okay.
no indication.
So in fact, the federal complaint and the earlier reports were not accurate. Is that correct? Yes or no, please.
I think the original complaint is accurate that Mr. Gonzalez scaled the fence.
Ma'am, hold it. I have very little time, and I'm not the American people want to know if there is a president safe. I want to know if we can rely on reports from your agency.
Is she done, Del Quentin Wilbur? You say she's only been there 9 months, but for crying out loud.
Well, you know, Elijah Cummings came out today, the ranking Democrat on the committee, and said she should go. And then Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, who, you know, represents D.C., where a lot of these issues take place.
Yeah.
She didn't go that far. I just got off the phone with her. She didn't go that far. But she said, you know, I have a crumbling sense of confidence in the director. And she didn't quite go say she was time to step down. So I think it's going to be interesting. Obama picked her, right? He tapped her to do this job.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, you know, it's going to be really interesting. You know, it's going to be interesting.
We'll look at that. Tom in Detroit, Michigan, calling. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
And good. And hi to your guests. You know what? I think that the CIA, they've just gotten too lax in their job.
You mean the Secret Service here, Tom?
Secret Service.
Around the president. Yes, sir.
But, you know, I mean, because this is not the first time that they've stopped this guy around there. I understood that they stopped him some while ago, and the guy had a hatchet with him.
More than that.
Yeah.
More than that. Tom, I appreciate your call from Detroit. He had 800 rounds in the car. He had a knife with him, but he had an assault rifle when he was stopped earlier in the summer in Washington?
Yeah, it was so interesting. So the experts I talked to, former Secret Service guys and other security consultants, the big mistake with the guy who jumped the fence, there were two, him getting over the fence and getting to the White House is kind of bad because it's obviously we don't want him getting to the front door of the White House. But, you know, Secret Service officers are trained when someone jumps the fence not to leave their post because it could be like a fake attack or something. So the fact only one guy was chasing him, they didn't release the dog because the dog might get the officer. I mean, that's the chaos of the moment. It's totally possible. The president had just left. You know, he went off to Camp David, so he wasn't there. And usually when the president leaves, there's a calm down, right? Like there's no one. The other principles to protect are not at the level of the president. And so you're not breaking in the White House to get to harm, you know, the National Security Advisor, right?
Who has but wait a minute.
Right? The big mistake in this thing was one, not locking the door, which is a blunder. But two, you know, they got the guy. The Virginia police got the guy in July with a shot-off shotgun, all this ammunition, and a map in his car that had the White House, the lines of the White House on it.
Yeah.
The Secret Service was told about it. They interviewed him. He didn't, you know, he didn't do anything illegal, and he didn't seem a danger to himself or others. And so, but they didn't put him on the list of people they're constantly monitoring. About 300 people they're constantly keeping track of around the country.
Yeah.
Then he's by the White House in late August, right, with a hatchet, and they find him. I mean, that's weird, right? And they're like, "Oh yeah, how you doing? Whatever." And they run his name through a database. They do all this stuff. But then, like, they didn't, like, connect the dots there. And they're like, okay, he's not a dangerous self, not to others. They go to his car, and they find all his camping gear. He says he's camping. You know, at that point, someone, like, he wasn't breaking the law. And so it's hard. You can't just arrest someone for being weird. But, like, you know, and then they saw him again on the 19th when he did jump the fence earlier. And they were keeping an eye on him, but not, you know, not sufficiently, I suppose. They're in a tough spot with that. I guess they could have, you know, grabbed him and sent him in for psychiatric evaluation. In the city of D.C., I think law enforcement can do that if they believe you're a danger to yourself or for others.
But even then, even if all that failed in advance, Del, here he is running all over, as you say, the White House.
Yep.
I mean, it's just,
I know.
It just looks like joke security at some point. Donald in Fairfield, Iowa. Donald, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I had two comments. The first was that, you know, every time the Secret Service does something right, we never actually hear about it. They're, you know, sort of a secret government organization.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's fair enough. But what about this? Come on, the guy's running through the front door of the White House and running all over the president's residence and offices?
I'm no military expert, but I would think that, you know, since they have access to all the 21st century latest military tech, that they would be able to have some sort of sniper up on the roof. They would be able to take someone out with like a tranquilizer or something that, you know, would be non-lethal, but that would just stop the guy right in his tracks. So that's my comment.
Let's see. Del, how about it? I mean, you can run across the White House lawn into the White House. This is now proven and nothing happens to you. Our caller says, why wasn't he taken down somehow in the lawn? Non-lethal something.
Well, they tried. I mean, they couldn't. They have dogs, right?
They didn't let the dog loose.
Tranquilizer dart. Right. They didn't let the dog loose because the dog could have attacked the officers by accident.
That seems like a system problem right there, doesn't it? You've got dogs.
I think that's a dog training issue probably.
But that's an issue.
A lot of restraint. Like, you can't be like shooting, like, listen, like a former agent said, what, are we supposed to draw a death line at the White House? You jump over the fence, you get shot and killed. No, I mean, that's not how America works, right?
But this is the leader of the nation, and we've got all kinds of threats in the world right now.
You know, some dude in 1976 jumped the fence, and he was running, and a rookie officer shot him. Yeah. And the guy had a lead pipe in his hand, shot him dead. You know the outcry that happened then? And what would the story be here? An Army veteran who was, troubled, PTSD, a hero, a sniper himself, had a grievance with Obama, jumped the fence because he's not in his right mind,
no.
Made it 15 steps and got blasted?
Okay, but here's a different scenario.
There are no tranquilizer
darts. Right, they don't take them down right away.
Animals, no one does that with people. And what, are you going to get close enough to tase them? They're chasing them into the front door of the White House.
Let's look at this another way. You say security was relaxed because the president wasn't there. I don't feel that confident of that right now. What if it was someone from the Islamic State jumping the fence and going through the door of the White House with more on him? They didn't know how heavily armed he was. You couldn't tell.
Well, when they looked at him, he was wearing a T-shirt and blue jeans, so he wasn't wearing a backpack with a bomb.
Is there a grenade in his back pocket?
The only weapon he did have was a 3-inch knife in his pocket.
All I'm saying is,
I guess, but
why should we feel confident that the president's life is safe if he can go through the door on that day? Take us to the elevator. What happened there? He's at the CDC, and somebody gets on the elevator with a gun in his.
No, he's in a hotel, staying at a hotel.
Yeah,
and there's a VIP. They have security at the hotel, right? And all these great hotels, like the Washington Hilton, all these hotels have security guys that like lead the principal with the Secret Service guys through the hotel, through the back rooms, through the channels, whatever, to the safe room,
right,
to their room. Well, this is what this guy's job. He's a security contract for the hotel, and he's done it, like, for 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he does it, and in the elevator with Obama, he pulls out a phone, and he's, like, trying to take a video or pictures or something with Obama, and he's not really sure. And so he's doing that, and then the secretary's are like, what's going on with that? And they look at that's weird. Normally, our VIP guys don't do that.
Yes.
And so they grab the phone. And they told the guy, what are you doing? They ran his background right then. They hadn't done it. Turns out he has arrest for assault and battery from the mid-1990s and convictions. And if you have a conviction for a violent crime or a crime, you generally don't get within arm's reach of the president.
Like yes.
They prevent people all the time for that reason.
But isn't that their job? Well, why was he there? It looks
definitely. That was a big screw-up. They should not have that should not have happened. And, you know, they're looking into why that happened. I mean, all these are litany of real screw-ups. I mean, it's not a joke. You know, you just can't be like the guy has some clearly mental issues and who jumped the fence. And, you know, like some of these members of Congress and others, like just open fire and shoot them. But the security experts and stuff suggest that's not the best course of action because, he's just deranged, you know, an Army veteran.
Kathy in Mystic, Connecticut. Kathy, you're on.
Yes. I would like to see an independent outside investigation of the Secret Service. I don't think that they can investigate themselves. They seem more interested in covering up their mistakes. Either a top security experts, the FBI, and then my second thing is I would like to see the director replaced by, again, a security expert outside the Secret Service. They can't fix what they broke. Thank you, and I'll listen to your comments.
Kathy, it makes a lot of sense to me, and I appreciate your call. Del, what about it? What's likely to happen here? I mean, it looks like you need a top-to-bottom house cleaning here. We're hearing about morale. Morale? We've been hearing about that ever since those shots were fired. I'm with Kathy. Get somebody in from the outside, clean it out top-to-bottom. I mean, how can we have morale issues, whatever that means exactly, and I'm sure it's a hard job, but this has to be on its game. How does it get fixed?
Oh, you know, that Elijah Cummings, and who's just revised his comment, by the way, on Twitter, where he was saying earlier that she thought she should step down, Pearson, the director. I have not decided about Pearson, but I'm not comfortable about the safety of the President of the United States. So he's revising it, kind of stepping
down. Why would he be equivocating on this?
Cummings and Issa.
Yeah.
The chairman, as you play this tape, both said they're going to send a letter to the Homeland Security Secretary, Jay Johnson, asking for an independent blue ribbon review of the Secret Service from outside experts, maybe some former agents and stuff.
Those can take years. We've got a president and his
months,
family.
Years, right. Yeah, but like you'd want to, like, but you also have to keep in mind that one, you know, the last time a president was injured in office was 1981. Two, these are a lot of foul ups, but like if you go in and just, like, dismantle the leadership and everything and restructure the agency right away, I mean, you could have more problems down the road, you know? And so I think they're thinking that they have to do it carefully and, you know, address what's happening in the service in a way that ensures that the president is safe. And I think that's why these representatives are calling for a, you know, an independent review from top to bottom. It could take a long time, but
let me get to one more caller, if I may. Mark in Oklahoma City. Mark, you're on. Our time is short, Mark.
Okay. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have a quick comment for you, guest. The general public needs to be pushed back from the White House, and I think the perimeter of the White House needs to be locked down. What do you think about the idea, if we take a lesson from Buckingham Palace in London, how they have the guard, you know, in full parade dress around the premises? What if we put U.S. Marines, sharpshooters, that are out there with loaded weapons? They could have a changing of the guard every day, make a tourist attraction out of it, but at the same time, lock that perimeter down.
Mark, I don't know if you're messing with us or you really mean it. You want to see Marines marching around in front of the White House and push people back like Buckingham Palace? Really?
Well, I mean, I think that the current system is putting the president's life at risk. And so
that seems plain. Our time is short, Mark. I appreciate your call. We've got an elected president, not a monarch. But is there a physical structure problem here? Is there a staffing structure here? Do we need something different, Del?
Well, I think armed Marines is probably not the answer at the gates of the White House, considering that he's like the civilian leader of the military, and we don't want to make it look like we, like you said, a dictator. You know, but I think they could, you know, they're evaluating all that stuff now, and they make fences bigger, they could have more security on the ground, they hire more people. I mean, all that's under consideration. It's just clear that, you got to keep in mind, I mean, there's a fence jumper every other week. That's not true. There have been 16 in the last five years. Now, six of them have occurred this year, so there seems to be an upward trend, but I don't know if that's a big enough number from which to make a statistical analysis.
Well, let's hope that a laser focus stays on this. President needs to be kept safe. Del Quinton Wilbur covers the Justice Department, Department of Homeland Security for Bloomberg News. He's author of Rawhide Down, the Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. Let's do remember that.
You can follow me on Twitter.
At
Del Wilbur, D-E-L-W-I-L-B-E-R.
Got it. Thanks. This is On Point.